You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Jim Duffy. Hello and welcome to this clinical negligence edition of the podcast, for which I'm joined by my One Crown Office Row colleague, Benjamin Seifert. Regular listeners may recall Ben's appearance on this podcast towards the end of last year, and if you missed his beginner's guide to extradition, it's well worth a listen. But welcome back, Ben, to LawPod UK.
Thank you so much for having me, Jim.
Ben, we're going to look at all sorts of issues today, touching on expert evidence, anonymity orders, witness statements, causation in the sense of making matters worse. But perhaps you could start us off with a recent lesson or reminder for defendants. If you're going to plead fundamental dishonesty, make sure you're on solid ground.
Yes. So this is the case of Wilma Agnes Cullen, and it concerns someone who had a very serious diagnosis of laryngeal cancer. She had and required significant and extensive treatment, which would have otherwise been advised. And she received a debulking biopsy, 42 sessions of radiotherapy as well as chemotherapy. And then, after a scan, she had further problems with a microlaryngoscopy, laser debulking, all these very serious interventions. She then had a removal of her epiglottis and then a total laryngectomy. She then had a bilateral neck dissection and a pectoralis major flap reconstruction. So after all these procedures, she could no longer breathe through her mouth or nose, but only through a hole in her neck. And she is therefore described in the judgment as a neck breather. She then needed significant assistance in managing this airway because lots of debris became stuck in this area. And she needed to have a stoma, so essentially a tube, which needed regular suction. Her son was caring for her, and he was trained in managing her airway as well as the stoma, and she also needed to have a speaking valve. She began to receive funding from her local authority for 40 hours of paid care, and then the NHS took over the funding. She needed constant suctioning of the secretions in her airway and also required a nebulizer. There was no evidence when judgment was entered for the claimant that there had been any malingering. But in any event, it was accepted that there was a failure by the defendant to refer the claimant for investigation of her symptoms on an urgent basis, and also that if the referral had been made, her cancer would have been diagnosed at an earlier stage. She was cross-examined for 3.5 days, and the judge was impressed by her honesty. The claimant and one of her witnesses were, despite quite strong cross-examination by the defendant, they were both described as honest. The defence also relied upon surveillance evidence, and the judge was really critical of the way in which the surveillance evidence was carried out. And the judge found that there was no evidence that the house was under constant surveillance because the defence were trying to prove that she was not actually as unwell or needed such intervention from her carers as she was suggesting. The surveillance evidence was really poor. There was also a suggestion that there was a Facebook video that appeared to show her dancing. But that video was not in evidence and was very poorly explained by the defendant. And so in this case, what we see is that the defense became very, very concerned and decided to allege fundamental dishonesty. But here there is simply no suggestion that the evidence held up. And the defence obviously suffered significantly by putting forward these submissions, inevitably unsuccessfully.
So they really went to town.
Yes.
But ultimately massively overreached.
Yes.
Another case that may have caught the eye towards the end of last year is MGF and University Hospitals Birmingham NHS Foundation Trust. Our colleague Matthew Barnes appeared for the defendant, and there's an excellent summary by our colleague Alina Ng in One Crown's Quarterly Medical Law Review. Not particularly groundbreaking law here, Ben. The case was about negligent surgery. The claimant established that a PEG tube, so a percutaneous endoscopic astronomy feeding tube had been inserted negligently with too much tension, and that the tension had interrupted the blood supply to the stomach wall where the tube had been inserted. That resulted in necrosis, so the cells in the stomach tissue started to die. And what can happen then? What did happen in this case is peritonitis, so inflammation of the lining of the stomach, as well as sepsis, and ultimately a hypoxic episode, so a loss of the oxygen supply to the brain. The claimant was already disabled, but the necrosis had caused a loss of mobility and the need for a tracheostomy. She also suffered a 6-year acceleration in terms of her incontinence and feeding difficulties. The importance of the case lies in the practice points for lawyers. So the first one is about pleadings. The defendant's expert had given evidence at trial and had started to come up with alternative theses as to how the necrosis had been caused. Now, none of those had appeared in the defence, the actual statement of case, and so it was too late to the judge for them to be advanced and relied upon at trial. We've all experienced a tricky clinical negligence case, particularly where there are difficult causation points, where experts might reflect and reflect over the course of a case and come up with new arguments. But the fairness of the process means that if there are new lines, then they really need to be bottomed out and pleaded as early as possible. That can, of course, be difficult depending on when your expert first comes up with a particular line of reasoning. The second practice point is about witness statements, and this time it was the claimant's side who were criticised. Witness statements don't always, shall we say, look like they've come from the horse's mouth. They're often drafted by solicitors and then checked by the witnesses themselves, who might not be particularly capable or at least experienced in terms of putting together a nice logical, factual account of what's happened in the case. But here there was a really important factual issue as to the claimant's pre-existing condition. And the judge observed what she described as striking similarities in the witness statements of the claimant's witnesses. It was, she said, very unsatisfactory and meant that she had to rely particularly heavily, not on the statements, which should have been a reliable narrative, but on the contemporaneous medical records alone. And then the third and final practice point is really about expert evidence, because the claimant's expert ran into pretty serious trouble after it emerged that he had not referred to specific relevant medical records to support his conclusions, nor addressed the defendant's case on causation within his opinion. He was described by the judge as demonstrably partisan, taking only the high point of the claimant's case. So it's a reminder, I suppose, of the importance of testing expert analysis in conference really robustly and when considering reports. It's not entirely clear, to be fair, what went wrong here, but it can never be assumed that an expert's done all the basics right, like reading all of the documents the solicitors have sent. Have they considered the whole of the other side's pleaded case? And like me, Ben, you've probably seen experts' positions unravel at trial for good or for bad, depending on who you're representing. And when it happens, it tends to be on those sorts of basics, in my experience. Have they properly applied the Bolam test, the Bolitho test, to each conclusion they reach? Have they actually provided an expert opinion, either in support or undermining each of the allegations levelled within the particulars of claim or the lines of argument running the defence? Things go wrong at trial, and there's usually a fair amount that advocates can do to roll with punches, but those sorts of basic problems can be difficult to do much about. And here the claimants just abandoned that expert's evidence. Ben, staying on the theme of experts, you're going to look at expert shopping.
Yes, I am. I wanted to say one thing. I think what a lot of these cases show, that you can be very confident when you go into trial that everything adds up, but it can be very easy to disregard and not notice significant weaknesses, which is why I suppose when preparing for a trial, we have to look very openly and try and test our evidence. But I want to move on to the case of Prescott Brann, which concerned whether or not negligent delay in a diagnosis and treatment of a stroke caused or materially contributed to an ongoing thromboembolic event in the left vertebral artery, and also worsening neurological injury. So in this case, both the clinician and the trust were defendants, and the claimant submitted that if his stroke had been diagnosed after his presentation at hospital, he would have received aspirin and not suffered a second thromboembolism. So what we have here is this is As a number of these cases that we're discussing today, this concerns a case management decision, which concerned the claimant's application to rely on a further neurology report. Now, initially, Master Eastman refused that application. And this case is important because it deals with the basis upon which a case management decision can be considered to be wrong. And in that decision, the High Court, Mr. Justice Sweeting, considered dicta from Lord Justice Lewison in the case of Broughton and Kopp. And so the question of whether or not a case management decision is wrong is whether or not it is plainly wrong in the sense of being outside the generous ambit where reasonable decision makers may disagree. And it's important to note in reference to the CPR that expert reports can only be called with the court's permission. And so in this case, there had been a number of case management conferences in which Master Eastman had granted changes, for example, of a neuroradiologist report, but refused permission to change experts in this case for five reasons. And those reasons were overturned by Mr. Justice Sweeting, because Master Eastman found that the application was made late, that Professor Wills, one of the experts, had maintained his view, and there was an allegation and a suggestion, as you say, Jim, of expert shopping. There were two other reasons, that the new expert reports would not greatly assist the claimant, and also that one of the new experts had only been provided with partial and inappropriate documents. So the High Court found that, in fact, and again, this all comes down to the question of real analysis of the facts, because I suppose we have experienced cases of people saying something, and actually it does not tally when people are making submissions. It does not tally with what the evidence is. So here, Mr. Justice Sweeting assessed the evidence and found that the views of Professor Wills had not been consistent, as was previously suggested, and his initial view had not been maintained, which was why it was acceptable to grant permission to rely on this further expert report. There was another problem with the previous expert because he could not engage with the report of another expert on neuroradiology. And a real problem here was that when a party has lost confidence in its expert, it is very rarely productive to engage in satellite litigation, drawing in all those experts. And so in this case, the claimant had demonstrated a good reason to change experts. Lastly, the application was not so late as to cause prejudice. So I suppose the important take home from this is that we have to approach consideration of these particular issues of when we need to apply to the court to get a further expert report adduced, that it may be, although it's an unattractive submission to make to a master, it may be appropriate. It may be a very difficult submission to make, but if we can prove and demonstrate the necessity of such a change, then it should be appropriate.
Thanks, Ben. Clinical negligence practitioners will have been closely following developments in another area which relates to anonymity orders. Those of us dealing with cases on behalf of children and protected parties have for years been relying on the case of GXMX and Dartford and Gravesham NHS Trust, a 2015 case, to apply for anonymity orders or reporting restrictions. Most commonly, in my practice at least, that comes up when there's been a settlement and you have to go to court to have that settlement approved, because unlike when you settle a case for an adult, if it's for a child or a protected party, you need the court to rubber stamp the approval to ensure that the settlement is appropriate. And what JXMX in the Court of Appeal said was that essentially these hearings are private business, albeit in open court, and the court should normally make an anonymity order in favour of the claimant without the need for any formal application, unless for some reason it is satisfied that it's unnecessary or inappropriate to do so. So that's been the way of it. That's been the default position. But how does it sit with the principle of open justice? And that's what exercised Mr. Justice Nicklin's interest in December in the case of PMC and a local health board. And there's another really helpful article on this on QMLR, this time by Leo Kirby. The judge emphasised that the default position must be open justice, and he cast doubt on GXMX, specifically on whether children and protected parties should have a presumption of anonymity after approval. There are five takeaways covered in Leo's article. I'll mention just a couple of them. One, application should be made at the outset of proceedings. Otherwise, an anonymity order might be attempting to undo something that's already worked its way into the public domain, or it's at least in the hands of a third party. Two, you have to present clear, cogent, and specific evidence to demonstrate that an order is necessary. You can't just do what has frankly been done routinely, which is just to turn up and have your barrister say, well, the claimant's 6 years old and it's really no one's business but hers and her parents. What settlement has been reached and why? So in this case, Mr. Justice Nicklin cut through the generalities that the claimant was vulnerable to exploitation, for example, and said that the risk to him was somewhere between very remote and non-existent. So even though the media in PMC didn't object to the anonymity application, they themselves following the routine, Mr. Justice Nicklin refused it. So a big shake-up, depending on what Mr. Justice Nicklin says, ends up being endorsed by the Court of Appeal because he's granted permission to appeal. The Court of Appeal, Ben, you'll have seen in February, issued a short judgment saying two things. One, it was going to hear argument in PMC after the Supreme Court had determined another case. And two, saying that in the meantime, parties should continue to use the usual form of model order, so PF10 for those who need to use that, for the sake of good order. So in that interim period, that order remains the one to use. Just going back then to Abbasi, this case that the PMC case is effectively being kind of stayed behind. Abbasi was about injunctions relating to the identities of doctors and institutions involved in end-of-life cases involving children, so Charlie Gard, Alfie Evans being relatively recent high-profile examples. These big cases where every twist and turn often leads to the news and provokes lots of debate over the incredibly sad and difficult issues raised. Does the effect of injunctions protecting the identities of clinicians involved continue after such proceedings have concluded, or should their identities be capable of public ventilation at that point? So classic Article 10, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, versus Article 8, right to respect for private life stuff. The Court of Appeal decided against the doctors and in favour of family members who wanted to tell their stories after the deaths of their children. That was a reversal of the decision of the president of the family division at first instance. Now, the Supreme Court has handed down its judgment in Abbasi, judgment perhaps eclipsed by another judgment in the gender recognition certificates case. In Abbasi, the court upheld the decision of the Court of Appeal, but for different reasons. So the families can tell their stories in what might be seen as a victory for open justice, and that could have some impact on the Court of Appeal's approach to PMC. So Abbasi was about the court's inherent powers to protect those who can't protect themselves. It's sometimes known as the parens patriae jurisdiction. And according to the Supreme Court, if the clinicians wanted to assert their cause of action to protect their private lives, then they had to bring a claim themselves, or more likely and more practically, bring a claim joined to the application for an injunction by the trust. So if they wanted the injunction to continue beyond the end of the proceedings involving the child or beyond a cooling off period following the child's death, then it was for the clinicians to bring a claim. That's not a technicality that applies in the infant approval context, of course, because there the claim is being brought by the directly affected party. So what the Supreme Court says about that won't be directly relevant to what the Court of Appeal has to decide in PMC. But the Supreme Court did also make some important observations going to this balance to be struck between freedom of expression and right to respect for private life. How should courts approach such applications by clinicians for extended or even indefinite injunctions? Well, the President, Lord Reid, and Lord Briggs, in their leading judgment, said that those applications should be supported by specific evidence, so chiming very much with what Mr. Justice Nicklin said, and the need for any restriction on freedom of expression under Article 10 must be established convincingly. The extended protection must be justified, to use a Strasbourg expression, by a pressing social need, and must be proportionate to the legitimate aim pursued. A permanent restriction would require compelling circumstances. So that's what we've been getting in these infant approval cases, permanent restrictions without much ado. And finally, the court can give weight to the importance of protecting staff against unfounded accusations and abuse. but also has to bear in mind the legitimate public interest in the treatment of patients in public hospitals. And it made the point that senior medical and other staff in such hospitals are public figures under the European Convention. So we're not really talking about your Joe Public, well, Joe Private individual. So those wider observations will loom large over the Court of Appeal's deliberations in PMC. So Ben, you're going to go on to summarise the case of Tyndall.
Yes, Jim. So this is a case which was, again, a case management decision, which ended up in the Supreme Court. So it's a strikeout application. And it's important to note that whilst the facts were accepted, they were never tested in any evidence because essentially the case was struck out. But it's an important case dealing with the tort of negligence concerning the question as to whether or not the police had a duty to protect someone from an accident. And there's a very helpful article written on QMLR by Lucy McCann. So in this case, there had been a non-fatal car accident concerning a man called Martin Kendall. He'd lost control of his vehicle near High Wycombe on a patch of black ice. And although he was in pain, he inspected the area, and extraordinarily, he'd previously worked as a gritter. So he then vigorously waved to passing traffic, trying to encourage them to stop or slow down to avoid a further accident. But because he was in pain, he also called the police who attended, and an ambulance came and they assessed him and they took him away in an ambulance. A police officer also requested the attendance of a gritter, but did not communicate the urgent nature of this request. And so when they'd all left, everything was cleared up, except the black ice. And less than half an hour later, another man lost control of his car in the same place. And sadly, there was a head-on collision. Both drivers died either on impact or very soon afterwards. And a passenger was airlifted to hospital and survived. There were many legal processes that occurred afterwards, including an investigation by the Independent Police Complaints Commission. And that referred the officers to the CPS for prosecution for gross negligence, manslaughter, and also misconduct in public office. They were disciplined. Two were found guilty of misconduct and one of gross misconduct. There was no prosecution by the CPS, but there was an inquest in which a jury gave a narrative conclusion that the officer should have done more. So what we have now, in this case, is a civil case in an action in negligence, and it was accepted that but for the arrival of the police, Mr. Kendall would have continued to alert other road users and would have prevented this fatal crash from occurring. In the High Court, Master McLeod refused to strike out the claim, but the Court of Appeal allowed the subsequent appeal. And what this case really focuses on is the so-called interference principle as an exception to the general rule on omissions. So, as it is said in paragraph 56, if A knows or ought to know that B is in need of help to avoid some harm, and A knows or ought to know that he has done something to put off or prevent someone else helping B, then A will owe B a duty to take reasonable steps to give B the help she needs. But in this case, and this was the difficult point for the appellant, whilst the court upheld this important point of principle, the appellant could not demonstrate that the police knew or ought to have known that they could have prevented Mr. Kendall, they were to prevent Mr. Kendall from warning other motorists of the hazard. And that is because the court accepted the fact that the police essentially did not know that they had prevented Mr. Kendall from alerting other motorists. Their evidence, which was accepted, was that he had never told them that he had been essentially standing in front of the traffic and stopping them before they arrived.
Oh.
And they did not know what his role was and what he would have done but for their arrival. And so he essentially, in the eyes of the police, was a victim and not a rescuer. This was described by the Supreme Court as a fatal factual lacuna, because none of the evidence was that he had told the police about this particular situation. And also the court was not impressed by a further submission that the evidence of the police's knowledge of his intentions would emerge at trial. There was a suggestion that it potentially could have been adduced or cross-examined into the trial. And that was described as a very unrealistic submission to make. The alternative argument that the Supreme Court considered was that the police were under a duty to protect motorists from danger by taking control of the whole of the accident scene. And the court refused this submission because they found that the danger was the black ice, which had extended from 50 to 100 yards, which was quite far from Mr. Kendall's car. Whereas when they had arrived, their duty was to protect him and the immediate area around his car. And so this is a very important case, like many cases in the Supreme Court, where they essentially dismiss the appeal, but make a very important finding in relation to the common law, which is what happened in this case.
Yeah, I mean, this case seems to add to the tapestry of cases from Enin Poole, Robinson, and all of these big tort cases that set quite a necessarily high level of generality, the touchstones for determining the creation of a duty of care. And it sounds like in this case, the appellants were unable to fit their facts to the rubric that's been set by those cases.
Yes. And I suppose, again, it goes back to we all have to deal with the facts that we're given when we conduct these cases. And however hard you try to invite a court to draw inferences, to open the door as far as possible, it sometimes doesn't work.
Echoes, certainly, of Enin Poole. Well, the final case, Ben, that we're going to look at today is Tuffin and University Hospitals Coventry.
Yes.
And Warwickshire NHS Trust. So another very good article on this in QMLR from one Crinoff's Row pupil, barrister Matthew Leach. We've all had cases where there's a strong temporal connection between symptoms or syndromes and a particular injury, and sometimes that temporal connection will go a long way towards laying the ground for a causation argument. The answer as to what happened sometimes seems to be staring the court and the parties in the face as a result, but this case is a reminder that hard medical analysis is likely to trump a more anecdotal, experiential type of expert evidence. In this case, pitted Lizanne Gumbel KC against Matthew Barnes. DVT and PTS, so post-thrombotic syndrome, were caused by the defendant's negligent failure to administer Clexane, a form of anticoagulant treatment, post-surgically to a spinal surgery patient. That wasn't in dispute. The question for the preliminary issue trial was whether something else, very significant, that's a left leg amputation, had been caused or alternatively materially contributed to by the negligence. So the claimant said that the underlying complications leading to amputation had flowed from the DVT and PTS, so that she should succeed on that straightforward basis. Alternatively, she said that if those complications were CRPS complications, so CRPS stands for complex regional pain syndrome, then she should succeed on a material contribution basis. The defendant said that CPRS had nothing to do with the DVT or PTS. So as always, this all came down to expert evidence, and the judge found that there was no evidence that the complications leading to amputation had been caused by the negligence. The defendant's pain management expert was able to carefully disentangle the relevant symptoms from the DVT and PTS and show that they were a consequence of the CRPS, the complex regional pain syndrome. The same expert's opinion was that CRPS would not be caused by DVT or PTS. So the symptoms were disentangled. There was no basis for a finding of but-for or material contribution-based causation. And what the court said was that I'm afraid this somewhat anecdotal, non-specific comment from a Professor Bradbury, he'd said, well, CRPS after iliofemoral DVT complicated by PTS has been reported, and I've seen a couple of cases where this appears to have occurred. It is extremely rare. The judge said, well, that somewhat anecdotal, non-specific comment was not something which could properly be evaluated at trial. No details were given of the cases or the instances seen by Professor Bradbury, and he hadn't been called to give evidence by either side at trial. And more importantly, perhaps, the anecdotal evidence was at odds with the experience of the experts who were at trial, both pain management and vascular surgical experts. So tempting though it is, the judge said, to reach the opposite conclusion on the grounds of coincidence, that the CRPS was caused by the spinal surgery rather than the DVT, there was no good medical evidence before the court to support anything other than an anecdotal connection. So a further cautionary tale, really, about the presentation of expert evidence at trial. Ben, thank you very much for taking part today. If you listeners would like to learn more about clinical negligence in general, or indeed some of the cases we've touched upon, I've been referring again and again to the Quarterly Medical Law Review that's published by these chambers, and it's a really good source of snappy yet expert summaries of the most recent case law in this area, and it's available for free online. Until next time, from me and from Benjamin Seifert, thanks for listening.